My name is Dario Hasenstab. I have 2 degrees in international affairs, and I'm here with Balder Hagrads, a former university professor of mine, as well as an IR consultant. And together, we're bursting the Western bubble. Today, we will analyze North and South Europe through the lens of the Western bubble, because while Western societies have many strengths and significant weaknesses, in order to analyze these, we use the concept of the Western bubble. If you would like to know more about this concept, how this podcast started, or who we are, make sure to listen to our introduction episode. Hi, Balder. Why are we speaking about this topic today? Why are we speaking about North and South Europe, or Northern Europe and Southern Europe, and what is even the difference?
Hi, Dario. Well, we've often discussed the way that the Western bubble behaves towards the outside world, towards foreign policy, what it means for the rest of the world to be faced with this creature called the West, and that lives inside of its own bubble. But we don't spend many episodes actually talking about the identity of the West, right? We don't actually analyze where this bubble comes from domestically, internally, within the West. And a really important factor in the development of the modern day Western bubble is actually this conflict, if you like, this tension between North and South, Protestantism and Catholicism, that has driven a lot of the dynamics that we analyze in other episodes.
And what are the facts?
Europe is commonly divided along a north-south axis, especially within Western Europe, for a myriad of historical, political, and social factors. Northern Europe is wealthier and more economically productive than the South. However, Southern Europe has a higher life expectancy. Historically, many of the core nations of Northern Europe, such as England, Germany, and the Netherlands, were some of the first to industrialize and had a strong Protestant religious movement. Southern Europe, on the other hand, was wealthier historically and industrialized later, and has a history of Catholicism. Exemplary nations of Southern Europe are Spain, Italy, Portugal, and Greece. However, there are some nations which do not fit nicely into either of these categories, such as Ireland or France, who have varying aspects of the aforementioned factors.
What is the bubble?
So when we're talking about Northern Europe versus Southern Europe, all right, and at the beginning of the fact sheet, I said that Europe is commonly divided along a north-south axis. Well, it's obviously divided along a west-east axis as well. But when it comes to the origins of the Western bubble, what we want to analyze today, it's important for us to focus on what we consider Northern Europe in this episode, and those countries are particularly the Netherlands, Germany, and England.
Yeah, nowadays the UK rather than England, I would argue. But the East-West divide is obviously very important historically and even in today's world, but it doesn't help us understand the origins of the Western bubble, because those origins of the Western bubble come from this divide in what would now be described as Western Europe, or Western and Central Europe maybe, where you very much see this North-South divide. So the fact that we're not going to talk about Poland or the Balkans or other parts of Eastern Europe is not ignoring the reality that exists in other areas of foreign policy and international relations, but just when it comes to how did the Western bubble come into existence.
And to be honest, quite frankly, I mean, I also don't know to what extent Poland, let's say Hungary or the Czech Republic, they are part of the Western bubble, or they are influenced by the Western bubble, right? Because, I mean, there are clear historic differences. And, I mean, maybe some of the listeners are from these regions, right? Because we can always see where our listeners are from. And we have quite a lot of listeners from there. Maybe you would like to let us know in an email how you feel about this, right? Whether you feel like you're part of the Western bubble, it influences you, or whether you are basically a contrary movement to that in within the Western bubble.
Yeah, when we are ranting about the Netherlands or about Germany, does that actually also apply to these Eastern European countries, right? That would be very interesting to know.
Absolutely. We're also not including Finland, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway in Northern Europe when we're talking about this, right? The Nordic countries, partly because they're just too well off. Right? It's always a bit frustrating to see how well they're doing, but also because they have a different political reality.
it's basically to simplify more than anything, right? I mean, I think you can make a strong case that a lot of the Western bubble also exists very much so in Denmark and in Sweden, but it's not necessary for the argument of this episode. For this this episode, I think when we look at the United Kingdom, we look at Germany and we look at the Netherlands, that's fine as representative of this northern aspect of the West. And then we look at Spain and Italy and Greece as the southern contrast, and that will be sufficient for us to make our case, I think.
Absolutely. So let's actually start with why we're talking about this. You already mentioned this before the fact sheet, but it's basically Northern Europe, these three countries that we mentioned in particular, that are very much driving the Western bubble, historically, but also still today.
Yeah, even though, for example, global colonization, which we have discussed previously in episodes, of course, was mostly started by the Spanish and Portuguese empires, and so was in many ways a Catholic project initially. That was before Europe saw itself as a moral guide of what the world should look like, sort of as this superior model of humanity that the rest of the world should follow. It was before the United States was created in its modern form. What you then see is that because of the North essentially defining itself as modern through the Reformation, by becoming Protestant, by splitting away from, if you like, the old hierarchy of the Vatican and other such institutions, and contrasting itself with those old Catholic empires such as Spain, the psychology starts changing. Northern Europe starts seeing itself as the modern version of what humanity should be like, even before they start spreading that around to the rest of the world, right? First, it's sort of a rejection of the old Catholic values of the South, and then once they've won that conflict, they start spreading their bubble towards the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. And I mean that, right? That bubble mentality, or the looking down on the others mentality, also exists within Europe, right? So the northern countries have a tendency to look down on the southern countries. I mean, partly, I would say this is very much from that, I mean, simply better economic performance. Having industrialized earlier, nowadays being better off, also kind of going through the different crises of the last 20 years a little bit better. And then on another level, I do think it's a big factor will probably be democracy, right? I mean, we both love Spain very much, but Spain is a rather young democracy compared to some other countries in the north.
Yeah, in its modern form. I mean, it played around with democracy before the Civil War as well, Spain. But yes, absolutely. So essentially what you see is that the glory days of the old Catholic South are in the 15th, 16th century. Then you see the North taking over. The North first taking over in terms of military power, in terms of economic power, political power. They provide a new version of Christianity through the different Protestant faiths. They start providing a new political system through democratization, through liberalism, very much things that you see in the UK, in the Netherlands, also, by the way, Sweden. We said we wouldn't talk about Sweden, but Sweden also displayed some of that, Denmark. And so the North is growing in strength at every level, politically, economically, militarily, culturally, throughout the 18th, 19th, and certainly 20th centuries. And the South stays behind, and the South stays stuck in their old ways to a certain extent. Portugal and Spain and also Greece, by the way, until the 70s dictatorships. Then they finally become democracies, and they are being helped by the North, that has been a democracy for much longer, is much more economically established. They can basically accelerate their social growth, but only through German money, European money, etc., and political support from those countries. And all of that process for hundreds of years basically leads to the North feeling that they are the vanguard of modernity, that they are the vanguard of what humanity should be like. On top of that, the North also sees itself as responsible for the United States, obviously.
And I think we can express a lot of this feeling in simple stereotypes that exist, right? I mean, right, that the South is lazy, they don't like to work very hard, they always have to be helped out, they're only asking for money, they're never giving any money. And these stereotypes particularly come out in times of crisis, right? So we've had, the 2008 financial crisis followed by the 2012 Eurozone crisis. And I do remember, right, because this was the earlier times when I started to pay attention to the news, particularly within, right, the German news, a lot of prejudice against the South, right? Oh, they're lazy. They just want to have our money. They never work for anything. Well, if you were bad with your money before, why should we help you out, right? That type of sentiment.
And that very much was visible in the Netherlands as well. This idea of the Netherlands and Germany, which is true, they're being net contributors to the European Union. And so technically they're spreading wealth towards the South. But of course, Germany and the Netherlands and others very much benefit from this union as well, economically and otherwise. It all helps to create this image of we're just better than the South. It also has to do with the fact that we overvalue GDP. Let's face it, we overvalue the importance of money. Money is really useful, but for example, the Spanish healthcare system is a very good healthcare system. It's publicly available, you don't have to pay anything, and yet every time I hear a Dutch person speak to me, they say, oh, it's a good thing that you still have a Dutch passport, so you can still go to the Netherlands if you're ill, which is insanity, of course. But there is this entire subconscious in the North about the South essentially being backwards. And that's really painful. On the other hand, that also leads to the South feeling unfairly treated by the North, right? And during the economic crisis that you mentioned, 2008, there was a lot of irrational anger and even hatred towards, for example, Germany.
I do remember that, right? So, I mean, particularly against the person of Angela Merkel. And something that hurts every German very quickly is, right, any Nazi comparison. And I do remember, like posters of protests in Greece or Spain, Portugal, where Angela Merkel was depicted with, right, that basically mustache of Hitler. And that hits very deep within the German heart, right? It doesn't make you feel very, very nice in that moment. And you always felt a bit, you felt that there was unjustified anger from the South towards the North. And we saw this again during COVID, right? So during COVID, when it was first Spain and Italy in particular, they were hit pretty hard. And then they shut down their economies. And then we had this huge problem of, okay, how do we get the European economy restarted? And the idea of COVID bonds was circulated, right? So basically common debt. And again, the conversation emerged of why should the North be paying for the South? I mean, we've been doing pretty well economically. Why do we need to pay for the mistakes of others?
Yeah, and once again, there is kind of unnecessary antagonism from both sides there, right? When COVID did hit Italy and Spain, their initial reaction in the Netherlands, I don't know about Germany, but the Netherlands was, that is just because they can't get their healthcare together. Obviously, we are immune to this because we don't have to worry because our healthcare system is great. And then 2 months later, the Netherlands goes into lockdown as well. So there is this arrogant attitude in those situations towards the South. But the South also finds it then very easy to feel victimized and to go into this bunker mentality of, we're just victims of imperialistic Germany. Germany is trying to rule our countries through their economic might. And that is, of course, also very unfair. If you look at the way that Europe in general, but certainly Northern Europe, has financially, economically supported the South, there has been a lot of benefits for the South. And there has been a lot of, you know, Greece went overboard after they joined the Euro. They went overboard with their public finances. They basically lost the plot with public finances. And then when Germany had to bail them out, you know, a reasonable analysis would be, okay, happy to have Germany there. Thank you, Germany, for bailing us out. But instead, no, the Germans put conditions on the financial support. How dare they? How dare they try to control our Greek sovereign nation? Well, that's because you need their money. Surely there's a bit of back and forth there, right? So essentially, you've got two sides of the same coin that look at each other and are unnecessarily antagonistic. And that goes all the way back to the 30 Years' War to the Spanish Empire crumbling and the Netherlands becoming independent through the 80 Years' War and all the history of the past few hundred years where the South has lost influence and the North has been on top of their geopolitical game, if you like.
Mm. So not only do we see differences in attitudes towards each other, right, within between North and South Europe, but there we already pointed out the differences in GDP, the differences in kind of life expectancy, right? So that's a bit of a surprise, is that, yes, the North is doing economically better, but the South has a higher life expectancy. Maybe that has something to do with the healthcare system. Maybe that has something to do with the Mediterranean diet and the general lifestyle. What we also see, though, is when we now move over to the political side, the differences in policy making and the differences in political culture. While in the North, you generally see higher levels of political trust in institutions and in the political system, they are much lower within the South, right? About 10, 15, sometimes 20% lower. At least from my four short years in Spain, it always seemed like any domestic political issue was fought to the death. And immediately the other side was villainized to an extent that I did not know that from Germany.
I think in large part that is because the Northern political systems had the chance to develop much more calmly with bumps on the road. I mean, you know, the 1930s Germany, of course, there was no democracy anymore left. But generally, the North has been developing their democratic institutions with a more stable pattern, whereas the South has had to very quickly catch up without ever dealing with its past, right? Spain is still caught up in its civil war mentality, essentially. Voting patterns still in many ways reflect the violence that happened in the 1930s in Spain. And so the Spanish political system is much more prone to this tribalism, where the North has had centuries to calmly move to a situation where you actually look at politicians and political parties as just tools to get the right kind of policy mix. And for example, if I look at the Netherlands, since the Second World War, there's always been a coalition government. There's always been different parties working together, depending on each other, respecting each other in broad terms, not shouting at each other, not seeing the other side as the enemy, but just as someone who was, as a group of people with a different ideology. And in that sense, yeah, the North has a system that is maybe a little bit more mature than the South, which has only had a few decades to develop this.
What's the international relations context?
Let's talk about how those differences between North and South Europe, also the differences within the Western bubble, how they impact the world, right? Because, I mean, ultimately, this is not necessarily a Europe or Western bubble podcast just looking at us, but we also like to look at the influence this has on the world. You already mentioned it at the very beginning of our bubble segment, kind of the difference in colonialism. And those were simply different. Well, I mean, first of all, they were different times, right? There were about 100 years between them. But there were also different realities when it came to how Southern European countries colonized parts of the world and then how later on Northern European countries colonized parts of the world.
It's important to realize that a large part of the bubble that we discuss in this podcast is the comfort levels that Europeans in general, North and South, have with essentially imposing their will on the rest of the world through colonization, through the Crusades even, before colonization, right? And it's important to realize that Spain and Portugal started that. So it's not as if Spain and Portugal are completely absolved from any Western bubble mentality, because they began this approach of Christian Europe telling the rest of the world how to live their lives. But the colonization specifically that Spain and Portugal implemented was about traditional empire building. It was about expanding Madrid's power and Lisbon's power. It was not about pretending to be, you know, an enlightened version of humanity. Whereas the moment that 200 years later you see the UK and France to a certain extent and the Netherlands colonizing the world, they are actually not just dominating other nations, but they're saying to those nations, we know better how you should live your life, and we're going to educate you. We are going to bring you to civilization. We're going to tell you how you can make your own society better. And that has an extra layer of arrogance and imposition that, if you like, Spanish and Portuguese thinking never had, so notwithstanding the enormous destruction and victims that the Spanish and Portuguese empires caused, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, and right, this other element that within Spain and Portugal, it was very much the elites, right? The emperors driving colonization, kind of saying, well, I want to increase the size of my empire. I want more money. I'm going to colonize the world also with this mission to spread right, the Catholic belief. While in Northern Europe, right, it was a lot more the societies actually striving for it, right? So it wasn't necessarily the political elite, but the economic elite that was very much focused on their own enrichment, which there's another level of difference between those types of colonization.
Right. The best example of that from a Northern perspective is, of course, the Netherlands, which was basically... Dutch foreign policy during colonization was basically run by one big multinational, by the VOC, who basically completely dominated Dutch politics and dominated the decision by the Dutch authority. Sometimes it was a monarchy, sometimes it wasn't. Where to go and what to do and what fleets to build and which sea lanes needed to be protected, etc., etc. And that's a very different mentality. Now, if on top of that, you then have that middle class that is running the show also believing themselves to be somehow morally or civilizationally superior, well, now you've got a toxic mix, right? That the rest of the world gets burdened by even more. Having said that, you could also make a comparison between North America and South America, where South America, as you exactly said, Latin America, run by elites, Spanish and Portuguese elites that then become independent, whereas the North was very much a project of people from Europe basically imposing their own agendas onto the indigenous populations within North America, basically wiping out those populations, and then believing themselves to be an enlightened species, to be better than the old continents, to be better than Europe.
Well, add another layer of basically toxic thinking to that is then once colonialism wasn't perceived as positive anymore, particularly by the people who were being colonized, then you somehow have, particularly the Northern European countries and the societies that were enforcing that right, that form of colonialism, changing their entire approach from, well, you know, I mean, we are the more advanced culture. We as the more advanced culture have realized that colonization is not a good thing. You should now follow our model because we are the good guys here, right? I mean, that thinking is one of those I can't really comprehend how you got to that point, but it's an enormous part of the Western bubble.
Yeah, it is almost unbelievable, right? It's essentially first through conquest, through military might, imposing yourself, then at some point, essentially because noting that it's no longer feasible for practical purposes, and then within the scope of a few decades, you know, I'm really, you, if you compare the 1920s, 1930s to the 1950s, 1960s, you have all of a sudden enormous mentality shift, and now it's the North saying, okay, out of the goodness of our hearts, we will let our colonies become independent because they have a right to, and we've just signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Of course, they should be independent. They have the right to self-determination. We're going to support them in that. Oh, but now they absolutely have to understand how brilliant we are, and they have to make sure that they become like us, or at least strive to become like us, because we are the example, we are the light on the hill for everyone else to follow, especially those previously colonized nations. I mean, it's not just adding insult to injury, but it's also an enormous mental gymnastics to go through that pattern, right? It's like two generations ago, you were oppressing these people, and now you're pretending that you are some kind of enlightened spirit. It's fascinating and slightly horrifying.
Well, and then you also have the, in that sense, positive case study for the Northern European countries of the United States, right? That very much helped them to cleanse themselves of this colonial past, right? And say, here, look what we created. It's working perfectly fine.
Yeah, and that is one of the reasons why the North could keep this going, right? Why Northern Europe could keep going, because they could always point towards the United States and say, this is the most enlightened version of who we are. We know that here in the old continent, in Europe, we still have some issues. We still have hierarchies that aren't always very efficient and productive. We have some problematic relationship between church and state. But look at the United States. They have perfected the model that we should all strive for. And the United States is us 2.0, is Europe 2.0, and the rest of the world must follow. And it turns out that the United States is a Protestant country. It is not a country dominated by Southern Europe. That is Latin America, but they're like behind. They live in another era. North America, the United States, Protestant country, very much built on the basic foundations of our own morality. Max Weber would be proud. Now the rest of the world can use that to be the best that humanity has to offer.
And that difference in their approach, right, to colonization, we see the outcome of that in today's relations between the European countries and their former colonies. Let's just pick France here, right? So France or England are, for the most part, right, very unpopular in the countries that they formerly colonized, while Spain largely has a good relation with Latin American countries, right? They're kind of seeing themselves...
At least more ambiguous, I would argue. At least more complex, not as obviously neocolonial.
Exactly, right? Kind of seeing themselves more as a gateway of Latin America to Europe, to the continent, right? But in general, for me, there's an obvious difference in how the relations are today, right? And this, I mean, ultimately results in Spain not necessarily seeing itself as an agenda setter. Neither do Greece, Portugal, or Italy. For them, it's not necessarily about dominating the agenda. For sure not within Europe, but also not necessarily with regards to the rest of the world.
Right. I mean, there might always be some weirdos walking around in Spain who genuinely believe that Spain is still there to educate the former colonies, but that is not your general approach. That's not the general environment in Spain. Spanish people completely understand their true relationship with Latin America. They understand that obviously they have no agenda to set in Latin America, but that there is a familiar connection, and that in many ways Latin American society has the same roots as Spanish society, and so they work together. This has to do with a lot of factors. It's got to do with the fact that the Spanish Empire collapsed hundreds of years ago, whereas the British Empire, for example, was still going strong in the 1920s, only 100 years ago. Spanish Empire was already on its way out in the 17th century, and by the late 19th century, it was basically done. 1898, the loss of Cuba. As a result, Spain doesn't have that pedestal. They are... arrogant enough to think of themselves as some kind of shining light for Latin America, whereas the United Kingdom and the Netherlands and the United States very much do see themselves as such.
Yeah, I've met plenty of those interesting Spanish people during my time in Madrid who have an interesting perspective on colonization.
There's always still some, but it's also important to realize that then goes back to the very traditional thinking about empire building, and Spain has never had, I mentioned him before, has never had a Max Weber trying to explain what makes Spain so great compared to their colonies, right? Whereas Northern Europe has had a whole philosophy built on why they are superior, why they are so much better than everyone else. And it's that combination of factors, more recent historical success, looking down on the South, having a whole philosophy built on why you actually are supposedly economically but also morally superior than those ancient Catholics, all contributes to a very, very toxic attitude towards the world, and hence the foundation of the Western bubble.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
Looking at these dynamics, and I mean the impact of these dynamics on the Western bubble, I think it's time to basically talk about the problems and the damages of this within Europe. Let's start within Europe, and then let's move towards outside of Europe. Within Europe, I mean, we've seen it during all of the crises of the last 20 years, right? So 2008, 2012, and 2020, there was a bit of a lack of solidarity towards helping each other, right? In both ways, right? I mean, on the one hand, extending a hand of help to the one that's knocked down, and the other hand, on the other hand, kind of accepting that help without too much, bad and hurt feelings the other direction, right? But there has also been a lack of consistency, therefore, right? I mean, we see this all the time, no matter what political problem we're talking about within the European Union. North and South Europe, they keep on bickering at each other. Throw in Eastern Europe and the very complex dynamics behind that, and you have a basically a recipe for stagnation sometimes.
Yeah, I think the European Union already had more than sufficient political diversity and kind of rivalry and tensions when there were only 12 members. Now in the current model with 27 members, that's a whole different situation, right? A whole different set of ingredients that could explode the European Union at some point, that could make it collapse. The South and the North will always, especially at moments of crisis, will basically be triggered by this very long-running historical feud all the way back to the 30 Years' War. And as a result, it's very, very difficult for the North to actually achieve its dreams of a European Union based on its own image, because the South says, no, thank you very much. We don't want to be controlled by Berlin. We don't want to be controlled by The Hague. But it's also a problem for the South, because it means that the South cannot achieve the cooperation it so much desires with the North, right? It will always have to overcome this kind of arrogance that's emanating from the North.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Looking at the global level, and I think here we can see more concrete damage, right? I mean, damage within Europe is very conceptual, based on a policy, right? Policy making, you will find inefficient policy making anywhere in the world. And I mean, I don't think self-inflicted damage is that bad necessarily. However, as soon as your behavior towards the rest of the world causes damage, particularly towards the others, right? Towards outsiders, that's a bit more of the serious damage. And given that this dynamic, particularly within Northern Europe, is the basis of the Western bubble, I mean, the listeners know this from all the other episodes, there's so much damage and so many problems coming out of this.
There is. It's very clear that the Western bubble is not just a number of powerful countries trying to impose an agenda on the rest of the world. That's always been part of international relations, always been part of foreign policy. Right now, you can see the Chinese, of course, trying to promote their agenda. You can see India trying to promote their agenda. Within Latin America, you see Brazil. Within Sub-Saharan Africa, you see South Africa and Kenya and Nigeria trying to promote their agendas. All of that is normal international relations behavior. But it is very much abnormal the way that the West positions itself towards the rest of the world, because it's not just saying, hey, we are powerful economically, militarily, and we want to set the agenda. It is actually saying we're setting the agenda for the betterment of the whole of humanity, because we are special. And that can be directly traced back to that Northern European arrogance that over hundreds of years have convinced themselves that they are the best version of humanity out there, and that therefore the rest of the world should be on their knees thanking them for their existence and for their wise example and their efforts to promote their culture, their political system, their perspectives in the rest of the world.
And what now?
So I mean, I've asked this question many times, and many times, especially after we've talked about these problems. So where do we go from here? All right. I mean, obviously, and this is the reason why we're doing this podcast, it's important to understand the dynamics behind the Western bubble, to then work on these dynamics and hopefully stop the problems that the West is causing in that sense, put an end to this. But we also see that the Northern European countries and also the former colony of Northern Europe, right, the United States, that they have not been doing as well lately. But Spain and Italy, for example, are. When we look at other measurements, I mean, you said in the beginning, right, we still look a lot at GDP in today's world, but maybe at happiness and life expectancy, the South is doing good, right? I mean, Spain and Italy have great healthcare systems. Quality of life is great. And I mean, there's a reason why you're living in Spain. There's a reason why I would love to go back to Spain one day.
Yeah, to quote the great Bob Dylan, times are changing, right? It's very clear that the world is starting to see through that sort of northern arrogance, especially because, as you said, the North is actually struggling. The northern model has been very successful at many levels, also in terms of well-being over the past 200 years. You know, the well-being in the Netherlands and in the UK has done really, really well over these past centuries. But at the moment, the North is not finding the answers to the challenges it faces. And so we're reverting back to a situation where it's not so much about trying to pretend that you're better than everyone else, but just looking at basic quality of life issues. And that's where the South has always done better, even when their GDP was lower, even when they were not a democracy, because of their long traditional culture. And I think a lot of people right now are looking at Spain. I mean, there's more and more Americans, for example, who work online, who choose to live in Madrid or Barcelona or Valencia, just because they understand that life in Spain is actually pretty good. And it's got nothing to do with ideology. It's got nothing to do with a sense of superiority about Spain. It is just that Spain is a really, really nice country. By the way, we should get paid by the tourist board from Spain, you know, to do this. Maybe we can pitch this idea to them. But the North is struggling. The UK is clearly on the decline internally. The United States is on the decline internally, facing serious social issues that it can't solve. And so this whole image, which was of course never based on reality, but this self-image of superiority is now collapsing. Nobody believes it anymore. Nobody believes that the Netherlands is morally or in any other way a better country than Spain. Nobody believes that the United Kingdom somehow has the answers that Italy or Greece don't. It's a different world in 2024, and as a result, the Western bubble is declining. At some point, it's going to collapse, and the North is going to have a very difficult time redefining itself, whereas the South will remain the South.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on North versus South Europe. If you have any questions, comments, or regards, particularly on the role of Eastern Europe in all of this, make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I chose a quote that exemplifies a little bit the core of what Europe and certainly the European Union is supposed to be about in theory, right? It's not about one part of the European Union being better than the other. It's not about Germany being superior to Spain. It is about the enormously diverse histories and cultures coming together to cooperate towards a better tomorrow. And this was nicely phrased by Jean-Pierre Raffarin, former Prime Minister of France, who said, "Obviously, there is diversity, but Europe is a union of diversity."